to welcome you to this morning's library forum. I get to pinch hit for Anne, who's unfortunately is in Cyprus. Unfortunately, she's not here to hear Susan's talk this morning. But before we move on to Susan, I'd like to just make a couple announcements as well as introduce some new staff. First of all, I wanted to remind you that the elections are coming up for the library forum, and there are some slots not only on the steering committee, but also on the career development committee and the mentorship committee. So please consider running for one of these committees and engaging in the incredibly valuable work of the library forum. And we were already talking to Susan about some new events that the library forum could add to our our art fair. I mean, at Syracuse, they do a hobby. Bring your hobbies to work day. So we have some new ideas coming in. So we hope you'll consider joining or running for one of the seats in the library forum. I also want to introduce two new staff members. I don't think Peter Halliday is here, is he? Peter? No. But Peter's joined the repository group within the IT group of in CUL, and he's a programmer with experience in embedded systems, internet applications, and client-server applications. Peter's primary responsibility will be archive development, and he'll be focusing initially on the migration of the Access, Browse, and Search system to a new platform in Vimeo. I'm not sure any Latin scholars there, I'm not quite sure what Vimeo means, but Peter's skills extend to system administration, and he admits to being to especially loving scaling systems. So considering the growth of archive and their e-prints, I suspect that'll be a fun project to scale. When he's not programming in Python, though, he's also playing around with some coffee gadgets, watching hockey, or involving himself in politics. So I hope you'll... I actually ran into him the other day when I ran into borrow a Kleenex up on the seventh floor. So Peter seems to be the only one in the seventh floor room. A very nice man. Also with Kleenex. And Sarah Wright, who I do know is here. Sarah, you want to stand up? Sarah is the new life sciences librarian in Mann Library. She's going to be partnering with faculty to develop an embedded information literacy program for the recently redesigned undergraduate biology curriculum. She's also planning to stay on top of information trends in molecular and life sciences disciplines and actively participate in research support initiatives such as VIVO and research data curation. Sarah has a BS in biochemistry and in cellular and molecular biology, and an MS in botany, and an MS in information sciences. She came here after being a digital librarian for the National Biological Information Institute. So it's a real pleasure to welcome you here, Sarah. Now, Anne regrets, as I said before, not being here for Susan's talk, but I get the pleasure of introducing her. And she's not at Syracuse University. But Susan is our upstate New York neighbor. She is currently the Vice Provost, and Andrew H. and Janet Dayton Neely Dean, wow, that's a mouthful, at the River Campus Libraries at the University of Rochester. And you may have noticed that Susan is about to begin her new appointment as the Yale University Librarian on July 1st. So we'll have to congratulate Susan on her... But Susan is well known to many of us for her pioneering work in user study. In fact, she's worked with several staff members here at Cornell. In 2007, she co-authored Studying Students, the undergraduate research project at the University of Rochester. And she also published The Academic Library and the Net Generation Student. She was named one of Library Journal's Movers and Shakers in 2005, and in 2006 was a visiting program officer for the Association for Research Libraries. Susan's academic background includes both a master's degree in history and in library science from Indiana University at Bloomington, an MBA from the University of Massachusetts, and a doctorate in higher education administration from Rochester. Now, I noted that in the Yale announcement that she did both that MBA and doctorate while she was raising two little girls. So, impressive. She's active in ALA and a prominent member of several boards. And as Yale recently said in their announcement about her appointment, Susan brings both a keen intelligence and an infectious enthusiasm for the work of libraries. So I'm sure she's going to bring some of that keen intelligence and infectious enthusiasm to her talk today, which is, why do students want to be in the library if they're not using the books? So Susan?
Okay. Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for inviting me. I'm sure you're hoping that my talk was the one dog love in paradise, but I'm sorry, that's not mine's the more plain one I called for now. So I hate to disappoint you with that. But is this hit okay? Help protect me. Okay. So the question of why do students want to be in the library if they're not using books? This is one that we've been pondering at Rochester for a while, and I suspect it is a question that a lot of campuses are thinking about, particularly when you have a number of senior administrators on your campus looking at your space and saying, boy, we could reuse that. We could turn that into something else. And we felt we needed to study this question and be able to articulate to the university why it was important that library space remain library space, and why it was that even though the students might not always have a book in their hands, that the work that they were doing in the library needed to be done in the library and not someplace else on campus. So that was really some of the questions that we were trying to ponder here. So as you may know, at Rochester we've been doing a lot of focus on our local users using anthropology and ethnographic methods. So Dr. Nancy Foster has been an anthropologist who's worked with us since 2003. And over the years, we've been doing a number of studies trying to understand our users, undergraduates, graduates, and faculty, why they use the library, how they use their library, what their academic work practices are like, and ways that we could rethink the library to better align ourselves. So we started with a study of our faculty, 2003 and 4. After that, we just loved the methodology so much, we dove right into the next project, which is a two-year study of undergraduate students. Then 2 years studying our graduate population. Then we've been looking at how do people search, that rather large question, of which Cornell has helped participate in that project through the extensible catalog software system. So we're building a software system, but to do so, we needed to first understand how do people search so that we could figure out the specifications for such a system. And then more recently, we've been studying the science libraries in the digital age. When so much of the literature has gone online, do we still need a science library and why? And then, I haven't even updated the slide, we've revisited our undergraduate student project again because we feel like it's been a number of years. It's been 6 years now. And those students have graduated. We're with a new population of students. How can we make some more adjustments to better align with what they need? So there's always a project or two going on in the library, and we try to involve as many staff as possible. Nancy Foster runs the project, but anyone can volunteer. We just make a call to the staff, who wants to volunteer? Anyone in the organization can volunteer, and then we negotiate with each supervisor to figure out how much time can they give to the project. So there's a reasonable expectation of how much work you'll be doing, and not doing 110 or 120% of work, but we keep it within the 100%. So the process that has developed over a number of years, it took us a while before we could even diagram what we were doing. We just sort of went at it, and then after a while it started coalescing. What is it we're trying to do? We start with a question. An example might be, what are the barriers to successful dissertation completion? We try to keep the question at a high level, has nothing to do with libraries. We want to understand at a much higher level what's going on for our users, and then from that we're going to pull out information about the library. But we're also going to pull out information that we can then share with lots of other service providers on campus and things like that. So we start with a question, and then Nancy's role is really to help us think about the message. Based on this question, what's the best way to start getting at the data? And it usually isn't one methodology. It's usually five or six different ways. It might be photo elicitation. It might be design workshops. We might have students keep diaries of where they go on campus, things like that. So from the methods, we then go to data gathering. And this can be a one-day process, this could be a six-month, two-year process. It depends on the project that we're working on. And then from that data, we sort of bring all the data together, and together as a group, we examine the data. And the idea there is that everybody in the room is seeing something different. And we want that plurality of vision about the data to sort of percolate up. So for instance, we might be watching an interview of a faculty member. And if the faculty member says something, does something, you see something in that video that puzzles you or it just was a surprise to you, you pause the tape. Anyone can pause the tape and we talk about it. So we try to pull out of it all the information that we can by inviting everybody in the room to participate in that process. Now all that's really actually sort of easy. The real hard part is right here. So now we find out where we're misaligned. Now we find out where the library could be doing things different and better. And we have to change. And this has been for us the hardest piece of it, but I think we're finally there. You have to change. You can only go through this cycle so many times and realize the need. And if you are willing to take the next step and force the next step to happen, which is make some changes, your users aren't going to keep participating. Your staff isn't going to keep participating because after a while, it's like, for what purpose? So you have to go through that full cycle, make some significant changes, and then start again. So it's a continuous cycle that goes on. And what I want to do is give you some examples that sort of go towards that question of why students still want to be in the library. Now, we've used this process to think about library services, the hours of our service desk, for example, the hours of our facilities. These studies have helped us answer those questions. Library spaces. How do we design spaces within our library through renovations that will make it better for our users? And then the digital tools. Our web presence is really grounded, we hope, in what we understand our users are trying to accomplish. So the research questions that we've been asking, and the ones I'll talk about today, is how can we explain student preference for using library space over others? In other words, if someone were to build a Starbucks-like a structure right next door to our main library, are all the students going to go there, or is there something unique about the library that brings them in? And if so, we need to be able to articulate that really, really well. Another question is, what do students need to make the most of the academic opportunities that we try to offer on our campus? And what can libraries do better to meet students' needs in a time of very, very rapid change? We just can't keep up with the technology changes that we're seeing, and their work practices, how they do their academic work, is changing very rapidly. What can we do to sort of keep up with them? So these are the questions that we've been probing. And I want to give two case studies that give you a sense of how we try to go about answering this question. The first one is the Gleason Library, and this was a renovation to our main library, which is called the Rushtrees Library. And the Rushtrees Library is this gorgeous structure that was built in 1929-1930 on the main Eastern Quad. And then in 1970, something really unfortunate happened, which was an expansion. And I don't know what went wrong, but they glued this really ugly monolithic brick thing onto the back of our building. It has no windows, it's filled with asbestos, it's just an unfortunate eyesore. But it's the main thing you see when you arrive on campus. You park right behind that thing. And then to get to the library proper, you actually have to go through a tunnel system or in our upstate winters, walk around the whole entire building to sort of enter it properly, to enter off the Eastman Quad through those gorgeous doors. So we have this ugly thing on the back of our building. That's all I can say about it. And we had a donor in the Gleason Foundation who provided us with $5 million to do a renovation of the space. And all they really said was we want it to be a space that students will use. And we said, fantastic, okay, we can do this. But then we were struck by, well, what kind of space is that? What is it that the library doesn't already have that would cause the students to want to come here? So we started with a design workshop. And literally, I wasn't dean at the time, I was assistant dean. Literally, we went to the dean and we said, we know the architect's interviews are starting next week. Would you give us one day to just start to get some feedback from our students? And Ron said, okay, sure, go ahead, go do what you want to do. So we gathered up food, office supplies, poster boards, markers, and we put a sign that said $5 free food, the flag. And it worked. So the students came, because, I mean, usually that's a great way to do it. It only takes about $5. It might have gone up a little bit now with the price of time. But the food is the key piece. $5 free food, we brought them into a space and we said, imagine the library has a big new empty space and they asked you to design it. And we told them it would be about the size of the Douglas Dining Hall, so they had a sense of scale for our campus. Exactly the way you want it to be, you love it, and you want to go there a lot, so it's what it looks like. And we had lots of things around, like
Rubik's Cubes and things like that to really sort of get them into a creative mindset. We wanted them to just blue sky. We didn't want to be constrained by what they thought the library should be like. So we ended up with all of these really interesting drawings. And this one is an octagonal set-aside space. It would be all by itself. All along the sides here, you have windows. These boxes here are windows. And it came clear through all these drawings the importance of natural lighting. Yeah, sun shining all the time. Okay, we know what the weather's like. That's not possible. Or sun lamps in the winter. You have a glass-covered floor, and under the glass could be student art or random other stuff. Down here, you should be happy when you're here, even if you're studying. It's just fun what we learned from this. And here's another one. So not everybody's as creative or artistic. This one was lots of post-it notes. They want a computer lounge with 802.11g Wi-Fi. This is several years ago, so that could be a dated statement. Movies and videos on big screens, mahogany bookshelves, old-style lamps, nice cozy feel. We got a lot of information about the texture of the space, the ambiance of the space, what they wanted it to feel like. We got another one. This one they tried to do 3D rendering, but we have mirrors or famous art. Here we have a fountain by a local artist, satin pillows, books. It's just lots of creativity, but that's what we wanted. We wanted to see the creativity, because what the creativity is showing us is they thought out of the box, which is what we want our library to be thinking about, out of the box, but also they had fun with it. And a lot of ways the creativity was calling to. There's some where you have a room, a ball pit, or a room full of mirrors and massage tables and things like that, which are outside of our academic mission. We could clearly say that's not our job, but it was suggesting the need for a place to just sort of relax, to sort of chill out, because the rest of campus was pretty intense. So from all this information, we were able to make a composite. And what we saw as a theme that came out over and over and over again was collaboration. That they wanted a space, and they would create in the drawings tables with 6 or 7 chairs and walls that could be moved and things like that. They wanted a space where they could work with other students. And when we stepped back to say, what is this telling us? It just became so obvious. Our campus's pedagogy has been moving towards team-based and peer-to-peer learning. So team-based projects, team-based presentation, peer-to-peer learning. But where are these teams supposed to go to work together? You would think library, and yet libraries often are designed to say, be quiet and work individually. So that became a very clear theme for us. Another one was flexibility. Within this one space, they had lots of little zones. And in the zone, I could do one kind of work, and over here, I could do another kind of work. And there really wouldn't have been one design that would fit all those needs. So what we decided to do was work with great flexibility. So rather than tables and chairs that need lots of people to move, everything that could be on wheels is on wheels. We added no walls to the space. Everything is temporary. Another one was comfort. They want to sit. They want to flex. They want to take a nap. They want to lie down. They drew ottomans so they could put their feet up, bean bags, all sorts of strange things. But they're conveying the sense of, I want some comfort in the space. I want to relax while I'm here. Also, it was so clear the need of food and drink. And we probably all dealt with this. I'm still surprised when I go to a campus, and actually Yale's going to be one of those campuses where I'm going to have to deal with the question about food and drink in the library. But every drawing had the availability of food and drink, because if I'm going to sit there for 2-3 hours working on my work, I need some caffeine, I need some refreshment. And so we were able to take that information and make a pitch to University Food Services that in this renovation we needed a cafe, and they put a cafe into the library so that we could have food and drink. For at least 13 years now, we've had no food and drink policy. Bring whatever you want in. Sometimes we bring the food. We'll do like just before finals, we'll do what's called study break, and we'll bring in tons of pizzas, and the food just disappears in a few minutes. But they're very, very thankful to have it. We haven't had a food and drink policy except in rare books and special collections, of course. But now we actually brought the food in so that you can get it, because once you get hungry, once you need that food and drink, what are you going to do? You're going to pack up all your stuff, and you're going to leave the library. And probably by that time, you're not going to come back.
you've lost that space, you've lost the place where you can plug in your laptop, that really, you know, coveted spot near the outlet. And we didn't want them to have to leave. We wanted them to be able to stay within the library. Technology. They drew in these pictures everything from plasma screens to a stapler. The importance of a stapler on campus is really an issue because professors expect the papers to be stapled when handed in, but when you print it off in the public printer, is there always a stapler there? They drew in outlets everywhere. I just need electricity. And for a 1929-1930s building, there weren't a lot of power outlets put into that building, so we really had to work on that. And then staff support. This was painful for us because we wanted them to draw in this space us. We wanted a desk and we wanted it to be standing there and we wanted to provide services. And when they did draw somebody, which rarely happened in the drawings, it was a very generic person. It was somebody who could unjam the printer, who could check out the book, who could fix the laptop, who could answer reference questions, and could make a really good latte. All built individually. So we looked at that. We said, how are we going to respond to this? Because they don't seem to want us in this space, and yet we wanted to be there. So I'll show you what we ended up doing. So once we had this composite, we picked an architect, and we went to the architect. We said, we don't have a program plan. Often when you're doing a renovation or a new build, you have a program plan that says, I want 200 soft seats, I want 57 tap seating, all that stuff. We had nothing. All we have are these drawings. And we said, we want an architect that's willing to work with us to figure out what we could do out of these drawings. And we ended up working with Air St. Gross, who is also the university's master plan architect. So they knew what the campus was going to look like in the future, or should look like in the future, and the pivotal role that the main library had there. So they went off, they took all the drawings, they came back with some ideas. And this is sort of, this is a scale-to-scale floor plan of the space. This is a staircase that we had to build. And we have elevators and bathrooms there. And then the rest of it is empty. So what we did was we blew out some of the brick and we put in windows. And then the architects and the interior designers laid out furniture in the space in a very interesting way. And they brought it to us and said, this is what you want. And we said, okay, that's fine. But let's ask the students. Let's just check before we go forward. So again, $5, free food, come help us out. And we gave the students this floor plan, and each of these is furniture drawn to scale, and they could put the furniture where they wanted on the floor plan. And they did something that was really interesting. Their drawings were quite similar, but they were dissimilar to what the architect and interior designer told us to do. And so we were looking at this and saying, wow, this is really different. And we started calling some of the students and say, can you just talk us through? Why do you want things where they are? So for example, you have these task tables here, eight-seater tables. Up here, eight-seater tables in front of the windows. Now the architects and interior designers put couches and chairs in front of the windows because you would sit in the sunlight, you'd read a book. Students are saying, look, I would love to sit in the sunlight and read a book. That's not really what my work is about. I need spread out with my laptop, with a bunch of papers and books. I need a lot of space. And they recognized that this was the prime location. This was in the windows and in the sunlight. So they moved the tables into the sunlight because they knew that's where they were going to be most often, not the couches and chairs. And then we said, an eight-seater table, do you really want to sit with seven people? And they said, no. This is an eight-seater table, but except during the exam week when there's no way around it, I don't want more than three people at that table. One over here, one over here, one over here. So when we laid out the space, we've taken out chairs. There aren't as many chairs as you would expect in there, and they're sort of piled up in the corner. And during exam week, those chairs sort of get pulled out. And when exam week's over, we put them back away so that the students have more space and more flexibility. Because architects will design space and they'll say, okay, you're sitting here at the table, you need X amount of square inches. And I think those X amount of square inches don't reflect laptop, textbooks, lots of paper spread out. That really should almost be double that space. And we tried to be careful to do that. Then we brought in the students and we said, okay, we know we need task chairs. We know we need colors. We know we need fabrics. We took all of the suggestions from interior designers and we narrowed them down to what we could afford and what we could live with. And then we said to the students, pick. $5 free food,
cooking.
Tell us which chair you like the best. Tell us which color palette you like. Tell us what inspires you. Because I'm not going to sit in those chairs very often. We aren't. Why should we pick? Let the students pick. Once we had bounded it within the realm of what we could afford and what we could live with. So we weren't just letting them go wild. We instead first made some selections and then turned over the final choices to them. And we've done this with a lot of projects. This is actually graduate students doing it with our graduate study area. So you'll see the colors are different. But over and over again, we get to that point and then we just hand over the decision to the users who are actually going to sit in the chairs. So I want to show you sort of how we did these outcomes. So the collaborativeness of this space, it is not your typical library space at all. And in fact, we debated whether we even call it a library, but we held to that name. We want it to be known as the Gleason Library, and it is called the Gleason Library. So you see in the back here, we have these studio spaces. So that's where you can go with your group. But if the group doesn't fit in here, they just make spaces all over the place. So the tables and chairs are all quite light. The chairs, as you'll see, have wheels on them. They're in a different spot every single day. The space is never the same. We reset it twice a year. We had a long debate. Do we reset it every day? What a waste of time. Yes?
Are those monitors back there?
Yeah, those are screens.
Yeah.
Flat screens.
Why are they so high?
Why are they so high? Because it was designed so that the students sitting at this table here could be looking up at it and sort of doing a presentation around it. So sort of like I'm standing here.
But they're right next to you. They have to actually strain their neck. Did they ask them to monitor up that high?
No, that was our design input. They didn't.
The reason I asked is, mm-hmm. We have a high monitor at Mann Library, one of our conference rooms.
Yep.
And he
I haven't heard that comment yet. Okay. I think we designed it thinking that they were doing a presentation practicing, and it is on an arm though, so there is some level of tilting that you can do to it. So we have these cafe-like seating as well, and it's strange that back to that couch is enough to give you a sense that this space is yours. And that conversation that's going on the other side of that high back of the couch is another space. They don't need walls necessarily, that they sort of create their own semi-virtual walls for themselves. So as I said, we have these subspaces. This is one of those studios. And then the walls are made of whiteboards. And they love whiteboards. Oh my gosh. They found writable surfaces we didn't know were writable. And then within it, we have these spaces, which are these little... They're meant to be office cubicles, so they have enough room for a table and five chairs, and you have power built into it, and they had a door. All of them had a door, and since we opened in 2007, all four doors have broken off. So Herman Miller has our input now in their door system. But it's actually better not to have the doors on it, because then you tend to change your behavior in those spaces a little bit differently when there's a door open. Let's just say this now. So we have lots of subspaces within this gigantic 23,000 square foot space. Flexibility. As I said, it's a new space every day. This is grounded to the floor because there's power all through that. But then it's hard to see, but this piece here is a table that's on wheels, and it can be pulled back and forth along that larger table so that you can sort of divide up the table as you need it. More stuff. Food, drinks. The furniture's not supposed to be there, but that's where it is. Some of it has disappeared. Usually we find it when they move out of the dorms. They leave behind the furniture that has walked away. We don't count. There's too much to even bother counting. At the end, we get it all back. We're quite flexible about this. But within this larger space, the 23,000 square feet, we have a quieter area. And in the student drawings, they kept putting this quieter area. And we said, but the rest of the library is quiet. We have this gorgeous reading room and all these other quiet spaces. Why do you want yet another quiet area? And what they explained was that when they come here, they want within this one big space the ability to move based on the kind of work that they were doing. So they could work with a group, and then when they needed to get serious, they needed to go to a slightly different area, one that was a quieter area. So we call it the quieter room, not the quiet room, because we can't promise quiet. And this is the only part of our building that's 24/7. So the rest of the building is going to be shut down at 3 a.m. the students who need quiet spaces to work after 3 a.m. can come here to work. What we did here is we lowered the ceiling. There's fabric panels on the wall that absorb the sound. And so you go in there and you know based on how it's structured that you're supposed to be quieter there. And it works pretty well. Every once in a while we'll have a student get frustrated, it's too loud. But for the most part, the design of the room expresses the fact that you need to be quieter when you're there. We also then built a media lounge, which did not work. So the students were saying to us, I feel so disconnected with the rest of the world. I don't know what's going on. I wish I could just sort of sit down like an airport lounge and just catch up on CNN and reconnect. And we thought, okay, we can do that. So we had two big screens and we had these couches that you can just sort of, airport lounge, which is what we were going for. And we just saw for 2 years, no one was really using the space. They might sleep on the couch, but because it's curved, it's hard to even get comfortable. They weren't using the space. So we put up a flip chart. It said, why aren't you using space? Or essentially, how can we make this space better? And what they said is, because you put those TVs in there, you lowered the lighting. So this space is actually darker than the rest of it. And that wasn't working for them. Also, they wanted to work. Even if the TV's on, they're still going to be doing some work. And the tables were just these really low tables, more to put your foot up. They're like coffee tables. So they couldn't, they were like bending over trying to work on the tables. So we designed a space that wasn't functional for them. So once we realized that, we did a swap with University IT. We gave them the couches, and they gave us tables and chairs, and we just created more group workspace. And now it's used just as much as the rest of it. But because we did not nail things to the floor, because we didn't build walls, we were able to be that flexible. And those couches are now where people wait for the bus. It's a perfect furniture for waiting for the bus. Comfort. Over and over again, in the student drawings, we saw the importance of windows and light, natural lighting. Not that there's a lot of natural light that normally comes into Rochester because of lake effect clouds. But when it's there, we want it. We didn't have enough money to do everything we wanted in this project, and we had to prioritize. And because we had such a strong message from the students of the port of lighting, that we paid for these really expensive windows rather than doing some other things that we really wanted to do. So we let them sort of prioritize to us that windows were utmost importance, and we dropped some other stuff that we really wanted to do. So the light is very important in the space, and it's really quite gorgeous. And clearly the students feel at home. They put their feet up, they are on the phone, there's food everywhere. The writing on the whiteboards is fascinating. It's mostly academic work, it's not graffiti. And it's fun to read. You come in and you can tell which exam's coming up based on what's on the boards. They just feel at home. And that's the kind of space that we wanted to design, because several students were saying the rest of the library, the more, you know, the reading room, I don't feel at home there. And sometimes I just want to feel at home. Other times I want to feel serious, and I'll go to those spaces. But sometimes I just want to relax a bit, and this gave them that feel. Technology and tools. So we have 10 computer locations in 3 locations in the Gleason area, but we designed specifically a space that would be laptop friendly. So in a lot of our studies of the students, what we saw is they were bringing laptops to school. They moved into the dorms with their laptops. But then when we had them take pictures of what is it that you carry every day with you, the laptops weren't leaving the dorm rooms. Now this is still dated evidence, 2006 when we saw this. But we made it a point that we wanted to create a laptop-friendly space to see if we could get the laptops out of the dorm rooms. Because we would love to not pay so much money for all of those public computers that we have to keep going. So if we can get them to use their own equipment, maybe this long-term will have a good effect. So we have 2 printers in the space that are wireless printing. We put power and data connections and everything that was stable, everything that was sort of stuck to the floor, we put things in. Then we cored the floor and put trenches into the floor and put power. So power is everywhere. This is the one space on campus you know you'll find a plug for your laptop, and that's what we were trying to do. So that's one piece of technology. And then the writing surfaces ended up being such a big deal. And when we opened, we put up a flip chart that said, how can we make this space better? First thing was we forgot the clock. We just didn't think about it. So we had to put a clock in. And then number 2 is more whiteboards. We bought a lot of whiteboards that are on wheels. and they move about the space. And what's interesting is they have two purposes. One is so I can write on them and work out the math problem. The other is so that I can define boundaries of my space. So if I'm working here with a group, I can pull this whiteboard over and it sort of creates temporary space for me. And when I'm done, someone else takes the whiteboard and it moves someplace else. So the whiteboards are floating all about in the space. And then staff support. Well, so we heard the message that they didn't want us in the space. And we took it to heart, as hard as it was. So there is no service desk in the space. You can get to us, we're just around the corner, you can get to us, but we didn't force our presence into the space. Instead, what we do is we wheel ourselves into the space with a cart and a sign when we want to do something. So we're going to teach RefWorks, get a cart, fill it up with laptops, signs, we wheel into the space, we go into a corner, and we do bibliographic instruction or something like that within the space, but we don't stay there. Then we leave. There's a lot of concern that having a space that this large, that was not staffed, would turn into some sort of wild party area. And it does get a little, you know, crazy at times, but it's been 30-plus years now, and we have not regretted that decision. And in fact, we all go home. And from 3 a.m. to 8 a.m., there are no adults in the building. The security walks through every once in a while. There are no adults in the building. The students monitor the space. And if they see something they don't like, they do not hesitate to pick up the blue phones that we have in the space and call security and say, there's something going on here. So it's worked out, but it was a risk that we took. But we decided we were going to stay on one end of the spectrum. And based on what happened, we would then have to shift our policies. We also don't book the spaces. It's first come, first serve, and that has worked out just fine as well. We thought we would be monitoring it somehow, and we haven't had to do that either. So why are they coming to the library? What we learned from this project was that collaboration is not well supported elsewhere on our campus. And this is where I have to impress the point of borrow the methodologies, but don't borrow the findings. The findings are unique to Rochester. On our campus, the students can't go to the classrooms. Ironically, what's happened is as more technology has been put into the classrooms have to be locked after hours. So they can't go back in the way that they used to go back as groups into the classrooms after hours. There's really no place else for them to go to study in groups. So we were helping with that piece. Not only is it studying in groups, but you should also think about it as sort of a buddy system of studying. Some of you may go to the gym to work out, and you might know that when you go to the gym with friends, you're probably going to stay a little bit longer, you're going to work out a little bit harder just because you have that peer-to-peer interaction. Students seem to study that way as well. They might not be working on the same material, the same math problems, but they want to be together to just sort of, that cohort sort of pushes them along. So this space gave them a chance to have a buddy system carry out of the dorms and into the library as well. The hours, we saw from the diaries that the students were doing, they kept academic diaries, when did they do their work? Their peak working hours for academic work started at 11 o'clock at night and went to 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. It was not because of procrastination, which was sort of our impression. It's because between the classes that they take, their part-time jobs, their extracurriculars, everything else that they need to do, the first uninterrupted time that they were getting in their schedule was about 11 o'clock at night. And that was when we were getting ready to start closing down the library. So this gave us the input that we needed to create a 24/7 space and had to think very differently about the design of that space so we could lock down the rest of our building and our collections and keep this space open. The dorms are too distracting. We do interviews in the dorms. We have them introduce us to their dorm rooms. Wow. It's crazy stuff going on in the dorms there. But the technology, the social interactions, the televisions, DVDs, Nintendos, Wii, all that stuff crammed into a tiny little space, we have 2 to 3 people living, is simply too distracting. The dorms are no longer a place that the students feel like they can work. And when they want to work, they have to leave the dorms and get in the mindset of, I'm going to go work on my academic work now. And to do that, I need to exit this dormitory and I need to enter an inspiring building, and we want the library to be that inspiring building. They're also coming to the library because it's designed to support the technology that they want to use. Again, one of the few places on campus that has plugs everywhere. The rest of our campus has not been upgraded to that level where you can plug in everything.
and designed to support various learning styles. So you have those whiteboards where you can write it all out. You can bring in food and drink. You can work in the way you want to work, and there's a few limitations on that. And we think that's why they're attracted as well. Okay, so I'm going to do a second case study. This is the Carlson Science and Engineering Library. We knew that the space was being heavily used, but the circulation of the collections was dropping. So we wanted to know who was there. Was it science students? Was it management students that came across campus? Who's actually in the library? And what are the students doing in that space? Are they doing academic work, or it's just a fun place to hang out? So you need to answer this question. Our methods included design workshops, like I talked about before, design your idealized space. So there it was. If we took the ground floor of the Carlson Library and just gutted it and started over, what would it look like? We then did reply cards, and I'll show you what those look like. We would do observations certain times a day. We walk through the building. We count how many people are here. What kind of work are they doing? Do they have a laptop? Do they have an iPod? Do they have food? Do they have drink? Are they working alone? Are they working in groups? And we would set up observation times and try to collect all that data. And then we do walkthrough interviews where a student would talk to us about the space as we toured the building with him or her. So this comes out of the workshop. So this is the strange floor plan of this building. It's really another really unfortunate structure. And what we found interesting was, so the reds up here are bookcases. And you'll see a lot of bookcases in these drawings. Make the entire floor no talking, no cell phones. Make sure to replace the flashing fluorescent lights. They really don't like the lighting in this place. More outlets for laptops. More outlets for laptops, because we haven't cored the floors of this library yet. An open, flexible floor plan. A shelf with copies of commonly used textbooks in the sciences and engineering. You heard over and over and over again, I wish I could get to my textbook. It's heavy, it's big, I don't like to carry it around. I wish when I came here you just had a textbook collection that I could get easy access to. And we're thinking about how we make that possible. We just don't put textbooks up. We did had a policy not to put textbooks on reserve, and we're realizing we need to rethink that. It says more and more stuff, computers everywhere, lots of outlets, it says. Small cubicles, less tables, not as many chairs, still has whiteboards, so they're redoing a study space that's there. They want to be able to get laptop locks, power strips, extension cords, desk lamps, and the most popular textbooks. We're back to that textbooks again. And we've been able to do almost all of this. If you need an extension cord to come to circulation desk, we'll give you an extension cord. You need a laptop lock, we'll lend that. You need a lamp, because wherever you're studying, it's not bright enough, we'll lend you a lamp. You want a prayer rug, you come to the circulation desk, and we'll give you a prayer rug. Why not? It makes as much sense as anything else. Again, book stacks. All that pink is book stacks. Oh, here's the ball pit, hopscotch. chess pieces, like a human chess board would be in there. They had fun with it, but over here is the fun spot, and over here is the really, really quiet spot. Is that mixture of zones in one space. Book stacks. So we had those drawings, and then we had reply cards. We took cards and we put them on every seat within the library, and we asked these questions. What are you doing here in this seat right now? How long have you been here? Why are you here and not someplace else? If you had to move this very minute, where would you go? So what are the alternatives? What are the substitutes to library space? And when is the very last time you were in the seat? And then if you returned your reply card, you were putting a drawing for an iPod or something like this. And the students, and you get food, of course. And we got over 100 reply cards. Well, and this is sort of what they started telling us. It's the quality of the space that is by far the most attractive thing of that library, even though it's pretty ugly. It's still the quality of the space. Books and materials available only here is only 4% said they came here for the books. So, okay, now we've got a problem, because we've been arguing we need to have libraries with books in it, and we've just got all this information that suggests that we don't need the books in them. But remember, the drawings had the books in them. So now we have this disconnect going on. This comes from our observations. It doesn't matter what the numbers are. The point is, different times of day, counting how many people are there. We can see what our peak times are during the week.
And in observing what the students are doing, and this can't be 100% accurate because you're just sort of making a guess, but what we're seeing is about 85% of the students in the library were doing academic work, 15% recreation, which would be watching a video, but a video could be, you know, Facebook, but that could also have academic. We had to make some guesses here, but this was our best guess based on our observations. And then the walk-through interviews, as I said, we would walk through the building with a student with a microphone and a recorder saying, tell us, when do you use this space? What draws you to this space? What do you not like about this space? And we were able from those interviews to sort of map out the building and say, here's where people are drawn to when they have a certain type of work to do. And when they have a different type of work, they seem to be going over here. So we took, in the middle of all of this, it's really interesting. So as we're trying to answer this question, why is it important to have a library on campus, the dean of the college came and said, I need to close the physics, optics, and astronomy library. And he said, the faculty are okay with it. Well, if the faculty are okay with it, and the students are okay with it, we're not going to fight this. If a closure is necessary, you know, we work for the benefit of the university. If they decided we need to close, then we will close. And so I called the staff together, and we announced at a general staff meeting that they're planning on closing this library. And I said to the staff, I know it's going to be tough. I know it's going to be really hard. You cannot fight this. No one is going to be compelled to change their mind because librarians are saying that you can't close a library. If our students and faculty are okay with the closure, we have to accept that, and we just have to think about what's the next thing for us and how are we going to continue to do our work. And to their credit, they stood back. They all stood down because we were ready to fight. We all had to stand back and just watch what happened. And what happened was fascinating. So the first thing that happens, the Facebook page goes up. The students fight for the POA library. The faculty had a fit. Had an absolute fit. They were appalled that their library was going to be closed and replaced with an engineering computing facility. And they started writing letters. They started writing petitions. And here are some of the things that the faculty were saying. Having physics books proximal, you can tell it's a physicist writing, proximal to physics studies is important. Those stacks are used when people study, do homework, and browse to expand their mind. Down here is sort of the most important piece. An environment where students get support from their peers to work together on difficult assignments. What we learned is that in how physics is taught on our campus is through problem sets. Really, really difficult problem sets. You go to class, you get the problem sets, now you've got to work your way through those problem sets by the time the next class comes. What the students do is they leave class, they come to the POA library, and they use our big whiteboards and our chalkboards, and they start working out the problem sets on the board. And what happens is they get stuck. But upperclassmen, fellow classmates, graduate students, physics professors come walking through, see that you're stuck, and they help you get going. And in fact, a physics professor wrote a paper, he wrote a scientific paper, which he submitted to all of us, that was suggesting, his hypothesis was that Rochester's physics department can graduate more physics students per capita of faculty than most other departments in the country because of this pedagogy and because this library exists and provided them with space to study. And it became such a compelling argument that the dean backed off and was saved. The physics, optics, and astronomy library. Now you think physics, with archive, right here. We have archive right here. So much of the literature has gone online. They thought it would be an easy closure. They thought that would be an easy one to close because people aren't using the physical literature as much. But it turns out that wasn't the case at all, that there was this very important role that library played on our campus, and they didn't understand that. We sort of knew it intuitively, but it took this whole process for us to start to articulate what it was. So library was safe. And from that and all the other pieces that we've been studying, what we came to understand is the students want to be in a place of scholarly gravitas. What they're doing is important. They're proud to be at the University of Rochester and going through that rigorous academic experience. They're fiercely proud of that. And they want an environment that suggests the weight of what they're going through. And that you can't get at a Starbucks. You can't get in the dorm rooms. They The library also provides the setting, the props, not in a negative way, but the actual props, and the people to adopt the habitus. In other words, as an engineering student, I wish to become an engineer, or I wish to become a physicist, and I want to be in an environment where I can see those people around me, where I can see the literature, because even if I'm not, if I'm accessing the journal articles from my laptop, I need to see them around me, because that's what I'm inspiring towards. I want to someday contribute to the literature. That's what it means to become the scientist or the engineer in the field. And to contribute to that literature, I actually have to know it exists. I have to see it. I need to understand that there are seminal journals in my field, and I want that around me, even if I'm going to actually access it in a very different way. So we feel like the library helps in this transition from a student to the budding scientist and engineer, that they want all those pieces around them as they make that journey, and there's no other place on campus that provides all the pieces that puts it together. Now, this is a hard one to convey. This isn't like a slam dunk, this is the answer is X, go away. It's more subtle, it's more psychological, but it's important to the students, and that POA closure, or the threat of that POA closure, sort of forced people to start articulating what we thought was there, but we got to see it firsthand, which is that the library is the place I go when I'm ready to be serious about my academic work. And at least on our campus, there are very few other facilities that make me feel that way. They literally will come to the library, some will come to the library, and they won't bring their laptop power cord during an interview. And I say, well, why aren't you bringing your power cord? And they say, well, because I know I have 2 hours of battery life. And so I'm just going to hunker down and work for 2 hours because then the battery's going to go. They're forcing themselves to actually do these strange things that will help them be disciplined. That they'll go, they actually will go to the parts of the library where the wireless doesn't work, where the cell phone coverage is horrible, to not be disturbed. They recognize that they need these things in their life to help them stay on course and to stay focused and to stay disciplined, and the library offers that to them, and they're grateful for that. And that's what we need to preserve. So what we're coming to around, so the change that we're going through right now is we understand physics pretty well now, and what the library could be doing for physics. So we're making changes to the POA library where we're taking out some of the physical journals and we're either tossing or we're moving off-site, and we worked with the faculty. And the faculty have showed us which are the seminal ones that they want their students to recognize. When they see the cover of that journal, they understand what it is. Because in the absence of the physical volumes, they sort of lose track of that connection. So they've helped us figure out what can go and what needs to stay, what needs to be part of that ambiance of the space for them. And then in those spaces where we were able to free up spaces, we're putting more and more of those places where you can have a whiteboard and chairs and you can work on those problems over and over and over again. So we're designing that. We suspect there are similar types of unique spaces that are needed by each of the other disciplines, and that if we took the time to really study them, we'd come up with a better idea of what's an ideal space for a chemist, what's an ideal space for a historian or a budding English professor. What do those spaces look like, and how can we build those spaces within the larger library so that everyone has the gift that the physics students have, which is a place to go, that they work together as a community and help each other peer-to-peer. We want every discipline to sort of feel like that. So we're actually going backwards. We're going towards that idea of subject-specific libraries. I don't think we're going to have more physical buildings. It's going to be within the larger building, can we start to design spaces that really cater to these different kinds of learning styles? And so my job is to raise the money. That's always my job, is to raise the money. So I've been raising the money, and we have the student drawings, and we have the architects working on it, and we're starting a series of renovations, and hopefully within the next year, the ground floor of the Carlson Science and Engineering Library will change, the Physics, Optics, Astronomy Library will change, the physical reference collection has been cut to a third, and we're putting people spaces amongst that to try to start to think about what do humanities students need and how can we put that in that space. So it's been hard decisions had to be made to move materials off, but we're going through the process and it will get done. We also want within the space to be able to host workshops and speaking events. students saying, I want to understand better what it's like to be a professor. What is it like to publish? What does it take to get your dissertation done? And I would like them to have a space within the library to come and sort of talk to me about that so we can host more events. We have that in our humanities and social science library. We don't have that in our science library, but we think there's a need there as well. Okay, so I wanted to leave lots of time for questions because we can talk about this, we can talk about any of the anthropological stuff or anything else, quite frankly, that you'd like to talk about. So I can see there's already questions. So,
yeah. I'm a therapist. I manage a one-room library, and you really confirm a lot that I see. You know, because my library is North Campus. It's the only library in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get students that not necessarily my subject area, but they love the space because of the windows and a little bit of the flexibility. You actually gave me some ideas how to better utilize the space.
Great.
So I thank you for that.
Uh-huh.
But my question is, a couple of them, I'll just do a single one because we've got a lot of questions.
Okay.
How do you deal with the issue of food? Because I agree with you, that's a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to deal with that all the time. Students all admit when I get food, and you're right, when you leave that space,
mm-hmm.
they're not coming back. So how did you work that through when you talked about the food?
So the food, the cafe that went in, we had to give up some space to make that cafe possible. And they actually wanted it to be bigger when we just couldn't free up the space. So we ended up doing a lot of shuffling within the library to make that space available. But we could show the evidence to the university that a cafe would be successful, and it has been wildly successful. And we were even able to sort of help think about the cafe in terms of it is local produce, well, not produce all the time, or you would eat much, but there's local providers, it's organic, that kind of stuff. And we could even help them sort of think about how you would thematically create such a space. So we did have to give up space within the library to make that cafe possible, but we felt it was worth it because we were seeing them leave to go get the coffee and never coming back. And we want them to stay in the library because the longer they're in the library, the more likely they are to interact with our collections and our people and our services and everything else. So that was one piece of it. Now, when we opened up Gleason, we had a problem. We have this cafe on the ground floor. We have Gleason 24/7, and we have garbage everywhere. So that required us to then sit down with university housekeeping to talk about we need a third shift. Because between whatever that third shift is, it wasn't that the students weren't throwing away the garbage. The garbage was simply insufficient to hold all the garbage that was there. We needed more recycling bins. But we worked with university facilities and housekeeping to make that possible. And in peak times, we all just chip in and help. Exam week, we all do it. Because we just need to keep that space clean. So we had to do a lot of thinking and negotiating with groups outside of the library to think about this space being a 24/7 space, which is very different from the other place. We also, I think about it in the same way, but it's slightly different. The bathrooms were an interesting debate because university wanted paper towel-free bathrooms. They wanted the hand dryers. They thought it was better for the environment. Now, the problem, when you have so much food and drink and somebody spills their drink, they had no paper towels to clean it up. It took a week before we realized first we thought, my gosh, why did they just walk away? And we realized there's no paper towel. So I had a fight. It took 6 months of a battle to get paper towels put back into that bathroom. But again, you have to see the habits and sort of respond to it. I don't know if that answers your question. We had to convince people that this was worth it.
I don't think it's sort of a step as a librarian. As a library staff person, I'm always thinking this is how we don't bring.
Yeah, but well, okay. So if you check out a book and you go home with that book, I bet you're drinking a cup of coffee. You might even be sitting in the bathtub reading that book, right? So it's like what happens when the book leaves the library is out of our control. So if the reason for it is the protection of the collection, I think there's some flaws with that. The reason could be other things. And there could be absolutely valid reasons. I can only speak for my campus and sort of my facilities. But we just sort of went through that whole thought process and we said, except for special collections and rare books, of course, nothing in there. But for the rest of it, why? What are we protecting?
things get spilled, but things get spilled all over the place. If furniture needs to be replaced, that's just going to happen. That's going to happen all over campus. That's what deferred maintenance kind of stuff is all about. So we do set aside money, especially for Gleason, because that furniture isn't meant to last centuries. And we have oak tables from the original 1930 building. That furniture is not meant to last forever, so we have to set aside money knowing we're going to have to replace that furniture on a more frequent basis, but that replacement means it gives us an opportunity to rethink the furniture in and of itself. Perhaps in 5 years' time, we're going to want very different furniture in that space. Other questions? Yes?
These two studies and what you've done with them are absolutely fascinating. And I'm particularly struck by this idea of the texture of space,
mm-hmm.
almost this tactile sense of the environment that
mm-hmm.
you're in. And you mentioned that when you, in the first case study especially, you handed over the question of the culturing of the space and the texturing of the space to students,
mm-hmm.
to the point where they even dealt the library staff out,
mm-hmm.
basically. You're only in there if you have to be.
Mm-hmm.
You said the staff are right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, what effect on staff culture
mm-hmm.
and this texturing of staff space has this move that you made to kind of stand things on their head by having the students define their space? What kind of effect does that have on
establishment? Well, in order to make the Gleason Library possible, we had to move all of technical services out of that space. So they used to be in that space without the windows. This is big, dreary space. We had to move them and we consolidated. But we gave them the same freedom, which is when designing your own staff space, let's bound it with what we can afford. You pick your chair. You pick, you know, the color of the carpet ended up being a decision that the departments made. They got to pick their own areas, just like we let the students pick their own areas. So I think there's a pride of space because they get to do it. I don't agree with the colors. I mean, there's one department in particular, I think it's a hideous color, but then I don't work there. I choose the color in my office. You get to choose the color in yours. So we haven't just empowered the students, to put it in one way. We've tried to give everybody that choice of environment so long as we stay within sort of the academic mission of what we're doing here. We can't lose track of the purpose and the mission. And if we put it in the ball pit and the room of mirrors, then we've really gone too far. What does that have to do with it? We can instead take that ball pit and mirrors and turn it into a place where you can feel more comfortable and relax a bit, and have a whiteboard to doodle on or something like that. That's how we've interpreted it. So I don't know if that answers your question, but we've tried to not just, it's not just the students, everyone sort of gets a say over what their environment looks like.
So the whole broad idea of the library culture is being affected by
that. Very much so. And at first, I think a lot of staff were uncomfortable with the idea that they weren't going to be in that space. But it challenged them to think about what would be compelling. If you're going to go in there, what's going to be compelling rather than I sit behind a desk and if you need me, you'll come to me, we have to think more strategically about what's going to cause you to approach me. What can I put out there that would suggest I have something for you to learn from me and I can impart to you? And you think about your job differently when that's sort of the goal.
Yeah, you were saying before that you want to keep them in the space because they might interact with the collections more than I interact with staff. So what evidence, I mean, what's happened in that regard?
Mm-hmm.
How have things changed in terms of that?
The use of the Rusheries Library has gone up by 30%, even when you account for the new seats. So we thought, we were fearful that what was going to happen is we'd open up Gleason, and as my colleague Katie said, we hear this sucking sound as all the students would be pulled out of the rest of the building and into the Gleason Library and it would just be a desert everywhere else. That has not happened at all. In fact, all of our spaces have now more people in it. We hypothesize what has happened is that the Gleason Library may be attractive to some students in a way that the rest of the library wasn't. And by coming into the library, they began to discover the other spaces that are there. And although I can't say this for sure, this is sort of my own anecdotal evidence, I think what often happens is freshmen start in Gleason, and as they mature as students, they start to move to the more quieter parts of our building as their work sort of requires that. So I think what happened is we made it a more welcoming place, and in doing so, they discovered everything that was in there, because before they just thought, oh, the library, it doesn't have anything for me.
I've said about the body count, yes, the door counts, but I'm talking about interaction with staff and interaction with collections. Is there any...
Yes. So circulation has gone up. I don't have the... You can look at the ARL stats. They're in there. Reference questions have gone up. But I can't credit it all to the space. In addition to this, we've done a ton of other work, including marketing our subject librarians. The legal librarian cards, if you've seen those little trading cards that we have, those have been wildly popular. So we all have an alter ego. It's really silly, but it works. And they're on Flickr if you do legal librarian cards. Students actually have really responded to that. That what we learned was they didn't realize that we were subject librarians. They thought we were librarians in a very generic sense. And here we had taken the time of hiring people with advanced degrees in these subject areas, and they weren't making that connection. So the purpose of the cards is to say, not only am I here as your history librarian, but I happen to have a PhD in history. Thank you very much. And so that sort of opened up that. So I can't credit it just to this. There are a number of things going on, but student satisfaction, the graduating class of 2009, student satisfaction in the library is at 99%. 99% were what was it, extremely satisfied and satisfied with the library. I think that says a lot. Other questions? Yeah.
I'm very interested in proof computing spaces.
Yep.
It sounds like you've made a lot of objection for people bringing laptops.
Mm-hmm.
But here we are at this point, we've seen a lot of popularity with actual computing spaces, and it seems that's not in there. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so even though this space is laptop friendly, and we do see a ton of laptops, we've been doing laptop counts, it's worked. We still have over 115 public computers on the library side, and then the main computing facility is within the library as well. So there's well over 200 plus computers, Macintosh and PC, in the library. And they're still being heavily used because you just want to look up something really quick. You just want to check your email. iPads are all over campus, but it's university administrators who are carrying the iPad. It is not students, because you still have to type your paper. And so I have an iPad, but I'm not seeing it with students. And we're watching that. We're looking for the adoption of that technology. Cell phone, mobile cell phones, definitely. So now you can text a call number to your cell phone. You can look it up on the web. We have a mobile website and things like that. But we still see that they're using the computer. But what we did come to realize about computers is we did an exercise where we gave cameras. So this is back in the day when your phone probably didn't have a camera in it. We handed out cameras to students. We said, take pictures of these things. One of them is the computer in the library that you most often use. What we saw was they're often taking a picture of a computer in the IT computing center, which in our mind is not library. It's in the physical building of the library, but in our mind, that's not our computer. That's their computer. It forced us to recognize that in the student's world, a computer is a computer is a computer. Therefore, the experience of sitting at a computer should be the same regardless of who bought the computer. That forced us then to work with University IT to standardize, and we have to do a service level agreement. We buy the computer, but the IT center sets it up so that no matter what computer you sit at, the same stuff is there, the same experience is there. So we've rethought computers by seeing it through the student's eyes. Not quite your question, but it's sort of a good tangent to go on. Yeah.
I'm just curious. It sounds like you have so many innovative and interesting ways to reach students and mm-hmm. get their input. How did you reach faculty and get their input about the future?
So for the facility changes, not so much faculty because they don't use the library in that way. But we've done work with faculty to understand their work practices, to understand the discipline and how research is done in the discipline, to figure out what we can do differently. And this was actually the first project we did with the anthropologist. And what we would do is we would target a discipline, and then we would target faculty members in the discipline, and we asked to interview them. We would go into their natural habitat, you know, to use the anthropological stuff. And how we got them to say yes would be something like this. I saw you just published something in whatever journal. It's fascinating. I would love to talk to you more about that. Okay? They're passionate about their research, and someone has just expressed interest in it. So more often than not, they'd say, absolutely, come on over. We'd come over with our cameras, with some of you running the camera, and we would spend 2 hours. And they would talk to us how they went from the idea the publication, and along the way they would introduce us to their laptop. We'd see what was bookmarked. We'd see what applications are in the laptop. Here's a filing cabinet. When do you hit the print button, and when do you keep the PDF? Those are the types of questions we could start to ask. So they just were talking and talking and talking. How do you network? How do you find about new material in your field? How do you keep up to date? All that was coming out of this conversation because we had an excellent interviewer, Nancy, doing the interviews, that she could elicit that stuff. So we learned a lot about our faculty. And I think for me, one of the biggest ahas of that was they don't actually know everything that I thought they knew. That their work practices sort of were formed at the time of tenure. I got to tenure, and it's worked just fine. Why should I change now? I'm comfortable with what I'm doing. So there's some faculty that are continually changing. There are others who've just sort of stopped with what works for them, and they're missing so much more that we could introduce to them. We just got to find the right way to introduce it. We can't say, oh my gosh, look what you're missing. You know, we're not going to insult them. We have to be a little bit more subtle about it. But it just sort of was that, oh yeah, they're human as well, and they need our help just as much as everybody else does. We just have to sort of target it differently.
Have you figured out any of those ways?
We did, I don't know if you have LibGuides, do you have that? We did something, this is one of my first projects, 2002, we created what were called course pages. And what we'd do is a librarian would create like a LibGuide specifically for a course. And we put down all the resources that we thought that course would need. And we would email it first to the faculty members, the link to the faculty members, say, could you take a look at this? Are we missing anything? And that was a subtle way to actually introduce them to resources that they may not have learned about, and they didn't have to admit that they knew nothing about them. They would get they would look at the page, they'd see stuff, they'd explore it all on their own. Some would admit to us, oh my gosh, I had no idea that that resource was out there. But by tailoring these pages and then inviting them to give us their opinion on it, deferring to their expertise, quietly introduce some things to them that they didn't know about. Yes.
Well, some things that you kept quite a bit of the traditional library model, even if it's, you know, flexible and everything,
mm-hmm.
It's still called library. It's still quite big. And it seems that, you know, it is so you keep it with communicating with collections and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So also the finger strip shops were kind of interesting that it's still such a big deal for people.
Yeah.
What about the people that might turn away, the people that are like, you know, they go out of the library because it's not providing them that comfortable space that they can work on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So quiet places are where nowadays they put the earphones on.
Mm-hmm.
Why was there an emphasis to still keep those traditional things in the library, even though that, you know, maybe there was there a demand for all
of them? It was actually a demand for it. So the Gleason Library was not going to have a quiet space. We imagined it all collaborative, but it was the student drawings that kept putting in a quiet space and drawing it over and over again. So we deferred to their desires to have that quiet space. I suspect there are lots of students that we have yet to reach. And what we try to do is sometimes when we do interviews, and you can't do all your interviews in the library because that means you're just pulling in the people that are already the choir, they're already here. We will go out to the dorms, we'll go out to the fraternity houses, we'll go do athletics. We'll try to do lots of interviews outside of the library system to try to catch people who don't naturally come to the library. Student Center is another one. And get a sense of what their feelings are for the library, what they feel is and isn't there, and if we can, we'll try to make some changes. But honestly, we haven't found a lot that's missing, and we are now full to capacity. So there's probably a population that we could lure in, but if we lure them in, where would we put them? So that's why we have to now go through and do some more collection things of collections for people spaces. Yes?
When you think of that, historically think about what elements are sort of there in your environment, people, philosophy that sort of put you on this really kind of incredible path of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talk back to like when Nancy Foster joined, was that the point at which put you there? Because I think that it was probably before that because it brought you to think about bringing Nancy Foster. And what was there?
There were a couple of things. Nancy was a key piece, but what brought Nancy there was a grant that David Lindahl and I wrote. David Lindahl is a brilliant brilliant computer scientist. He used to work at Xerox PARC, Palo Alto Research Center. And he got tired of not knowing whether Xerox was going to be there the next day. And he was based in Rochester. So in 2001, when I advertised for a webmaster, David showed up. I mean, what great fortune was that? David appeared. And David said, hey, at Xerox PARC, what Xerox does is they go into work environments and they study how people do their work to think about things that Xerox could do differently. Maybe we should do that here. That was the inspiration for the grant, the IMLS grant that we wrote. And I said, I'm the reasonable one. I said, good luck trying to get, you know, being able to hire a social scientist. We're going to need a grant. So together we wrote the grant, brought Nancy in. A year working with Nancy, everyone else was bought into it, and it was a fun project. So that was one piece, and David's still there. We also started doing usability studies pretty early on. We were inspired by Geraldine Beldoff, who at the time was at Arizona. But we learned about usability studies and brought that technique to Canvas, and we had a champion in Brenda Reed to make that possible. So what I mean by usability study is before any piece of our website goes out, it must pass a usability test where real users try to do the real task that this page is designed for. And if they fail, it doesn't matter how many people on the committee like that page. It has failed. It goes back. And that became the arbiter, the final arbiter as to what gets released to the public and what doesn't. And literally the dean of the library had to sit us all down and say, I don't care anymore. Usability is the final arbiter. End of story. So there were some hard, you know, just definitive decisions that were made, and usability was another big piece of it. But once you start doing usability and you see how flawed we can think about what our users think about, you just sort of become much more aware of it, and then you start to defer more and more and more to your users, and you start to trust your users more. So that was another piece of it. The way we're situated organizationally within the University of Rochester is we have a lot of freedom. Our money comes from different sources, but at the end of the day, we're sort of allowed to make our own decisions as to what happens in it. So being the dean, I can now say there's a lack of micromanagement from the rest of the university that lets us be creative. And then the day that the Chronicle of Higher Education did a three-page article on the library and the anthropologist, that was it. At that point, we were golden on campus. And what it's done, though, is we've become the hammer for every nail on campus, whether it has anything to do with the library or not. And we tried very hard to say yes to all those opportunities because who knows what it's going to grow into. Writing center needs more writing fellows. Yes, we will cross-train. Student advising needs more student advisors. Yes, we will do it. I'm a student advisor. I love it. Such an informative exercise. But no one would have thought about us until sort of this article came out, and then they start thinking about us. But we get things like, the Board of Trustees won't use the SharePoint site. Can you figure out why? Probably not, but I'll be willing to do a usability study on it and give you some ideas. We've just become that key go-to place. And so now it just builds and builds and builds. So when the resources came, we were not hit the way others were. We were flat, which is still hard for inflationary. We were flat while others took a hit because to hit us means we're going to have to retrench and we can't help the writing center. We can't help students dividing all the other stuff on campus that we do. We're just really appreciated now in a way that you wouldn't have said 15 years ago. So, but it took a lot of work and time. But there are key people along the way and just the freedom to work that. I don't know what it is here. We aren't faculty status. We aren't union either. So when work comes up, it's just who wants to do it. It doesn't matter what your job description said. Who wants to participate? And so it's given a freedom of flexibility in your job that not every campus has. And I fully recognize that sometimes that gets in the way of these kinds of projects. It's like, well, that's not my job description, or the union won't allow me to participate. We don't have that either. So there's a lot of flexibility that's unique to us, I think. One more question? Or we just
okay. Could you tell us a little bit more about similarities and differences between undergrads and grads? I assume most of what you're talking about was undergrads,
yep.
But also, yeah, in relation to the use of space and mm-hmm. library needs.
So we did a two-year study of our graduate students following that undergrad, and what they said so clearly was, we need space, but we don't want the Gleason Library. That is not for us. In fact, what they want was mature space. They want space that reflects what a professor's space might be like. And in particular, what we found was there's our humanities students who were the most disenfranchised because they weren't in labs. They weren't in the top departments that had extra space to give them offices. And the library's carrels are largely gone. Their IT closets are all sorts of other things, but they're not carrels. So there's a 7-year waiting list to get a carrel. We were able to take that, and so what we saw the humanities students were doing is they were staying in their apartments, off campus, feeling very isolated, very alone, not a part of the community. And so we were able to take that story of how we thought we could really change things for our humanities graduate students and go to a donor, Marty Messenger, longtime supporter of the library, and said, Marty, I think we can do something about this, and I have a space. It's full of asbestos, has no air conditioning, it's an actual dump. But with enough money, we can convert it into a graduate student area. And it had the stories. And he bought in. So it's a really high cost per square footage to get 3 abatements it took. We put in air conditioning, but we created the Messenger graduate study. And then we had to call it the graduate study north. Because halfway through the project, Marty shows up and he sees it and he sees what it's going to be. He says, wait, there's a space over there. Same problem. I'll write a second check. So we now have north and south graduate student study spaces. Mature feel to the room, not office and doctor office. Not doctor office, they said. Mature space to the room. There's tables to work. There's smaller carrels to work in. There's comfortable chairs because you might have to read a lot, a long book. There's lockers. We can't give you a carrel, but we can give you a nice-looking locker with a key. And that key is a sense of ownership. And you get to keep that locker as long as you're a graduate student. We have about 160 lockers in these 2 spaces. So a lot of our students get to have a locker big enough to keep your laptop in, your books in, so that you don't have to drag it back and forth to campus. So we have a paper that we wrote that sort of describes it, and it's our repository. I'd be glad to forward it to you. But graduate students needed something very, very different, and we really focused in on our humanities students because they wanted a space where they could go. They know they're working alone, but they want to be in the company of others suffering as they are suffering to know that this is the journey. It's a painful journey, but it is the journey, and you're not alone on it. And you could be in a room with others who are suffering like that. And that was sort of the philosophy of what designed those spaces. Very, very successful spaces. Had to be graduate student only. And I said, I'm not comfortable with that. You know, why graduate student only? And they said, I'm a TA. I'm a lab assistant. I have all these other roles on campus, and if I'm in the library, students come up to me and start, you know, assaulting me with all these questions. I need some place to go where I can just be a graduate student working on my dissertation. And once they articulated that, we said, absolutely. So it's graduate student only spaces on the side of the reading room. Come up with it. I've got you. All right.
Well, Susan, so thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Wonderful presentation, and thank you, everyone.
Hi.
I'm just going to mention, excuse me, I'm just going to run to the ladies, I'll be right back.
Okay.
Because we're going to lunch. Let me turn this off. I feel very, very conscious of the fact that I'm being recorded. Oh, wait.